In Genesis chapter 3, the first sacrifice is implied. Adam and Eve had sinned against God. In Genesis 3:7, we're told that they sewed fig leaves together to cover themselves. But in chapter 3:21 of Genesis, we're told that God made Adam and Eve garments of skin. And these skins would have been obtained through the death of an animal, at least one. In other words, in Genesis, what you have established by the Lord after sin is a sacrificial covering. It's a picture of atonement, a foreshadowing of these offerings, which Leviticus 1-7 unpacks. I think Genesis, in these opening chapters, contains in seed form, in a small micro way, what is unpacked on a larger scale in Leviticus 1-7. We have seen five major offerings in Leviticus 1-7, and what we are looking at today is not a new offering. We've reached the cap of that. Instead, what we're going to do is what we're going to call a revisiting of these offerings. These five basic offerings have been given from the lay Israelites' point of view, but if you're the priest, you have a number of important clarifications and addendums, you might say, that are going to be relevant for you. And all of this in chapters 6 and 7 here will bring to completion the first major section of the book. So we have worked hard to get to this point tonight to actually end a major section of Leviticus, the first seven chapters, which think about five offerings. First laying each of them out, and now tonight a little bit more information and insight into each of them. And so well done to you for going through the details of this with me, pacing ourselves, thinking about each of these offerings. I also want to keep in mind that all of these offerings have to do with this important sanctuary, this tabernacle that had been built at the end of Exodus, and now Israel is learning, I'm going to approach God through sacrifice. He invites me into fellowship with him, and how will that be? It will be through a substitute. Now, the burnt offering, as well as the other offerings, are all given on this bronze altar in the courtyard. We've seen this picture time and time again, and we'll continue to see it on occasion as it seems relevant. What we need to review are just to highlight what these five offerings were, because they're going to be mentioned in our chapter tonight. So the first chapter of Leviticus mentioned a whole burnt offering, where an entire animal, either from the herd or from the flock or from birds, is given unto the Lord, burned entirely. The second offering was not about an animal. It was about grain that could have been cooked or uncooked. But either way, it was about giving thanks and devotion to God, to tribute or praise unto God. In Leviticus 3, there was a peace or fellowship offering, which marked that what God has brought me into is a communion with God I'm to be thankful for. And in Leviticus 4 into chapter 5, an offering of purifying or cleansing defilement. It turns out that there are various statuses highlighted in Leviticus 4 and 5. If you were a priest, or if you were a leader of a clan or a common Israelite, there are various rituals involved for you to cleanse what you defiled. If you were a priest, it was the most involved for you. You would actually enter the tabernacle tent itself. You would cast blood upon the veil because your defilement is connected to your access. And therefore, since you could go into the tent of meeting, well, the cleansing of your sin involved the actual purification of the place. And then the last offering that we saw last time was in Leviticus 5 and into chapter 6, known as the guilt offering, or what you might call the trespass offering. And this meant, essentially, God has boundaries, and if I trespass those, either because I'm partaking in food or trampling holy access points or eating food I should not have been eating that was reserved for priests, or breaking oaths I've sworn in God's name, these are all various ways to transgress and incur guilt for trespassing the name of the Lord, profaning his name. And so each of these five offerings have taken us to the point tonight where we're going to think about these in a revisiting kind of way. So just to mention one more time to reiterate this, Adam and Eve experienced the first offering as God covers their sin and atones for their sin foreshadowed in the skins of animals. We don't get a narration in Genesis 3 of what that sacrifice looked like or entailed. But Adam and Eve's fig leaf coverings were inadequate. They could not cover themselves adequately before God. Rather, they needed God to initiate and provide a sacrifice. So now what was unique for Adam and Eve in that garden moment is a corporate reality for the nation of Israel. Israel is like a corporate Adam under the covering grace of God, where they are trusting God's provision and instruction through this tabernacle system. And they're trusting that as these offerings are given, God is bringing us into communion with Him. And I am being welcomed into the presence of a holy and righteous God, though I am unholy and unrighteous. So let's revisit together the burnt offering. All right, so as we think about the burnt offering tonight, chapter 6, 8 through 13 revisits the burnt offering. This was back in Leviticus 1. So let's see what we can remember as well as expand on. In verses 8 and 9, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, command Aaron and his sons. This should signal to us, these are instructions especially relevant for priests. Aaron and his sons were to be the priests for the nation. And say to them, this is the law of the burnt offering. The burnt offering shall be on the hearth on the altar all night, which means on the top of the altar, burning until the morning. And the fire of the altar shall be kept burning on it. This burnt offering is something that individual Israelites could bring. But because this is to the priests, here's what you need to know about the priests. No matter what any other Israelite family did, the priests would offer a burnt offering on behalf of the nation every morning, and they would offer a burnt offering every night. That's what this is talking about here. So it's still about a burnt offering, but not just the individual offering. The priests would offer a burnt offering every morning and every night. So as they put that evening offering on, is somebody going to show back up at 1 or 2 in the morning and take that thing off? No, it's going to be there all night burning. In fact, it tells us at the end of verse 9 that the fire of the altar shall be kept burning on it. This should indicate that the people who are finishing up their priestly duties for the night actually have to ensure that there's enough wood on the altar so that the offering will burn. And so here's a picture of the altar in the daytime. And there would be smoke coming out of that thing at night as well. You'd be able to see fire and wood. That fire was to be kept burning. That might seem strange to you. If you are camping somewhere and you've got a fire lit, you might be thinking, why do you put that out before I go to bed? That's not the case for the tabernacle courtyard. The tabernacle courtyard has in this bronze altar an ongoing continual fire to be ensured by the priests. Think about the symbolism of that, because this represents the communion with God. This represents the on behalf of Israel offering, and it's never ceasing. It tells us in verse 10 that the priest shall put on his linen garment and put his linen undergarment on his body, which means that nakedness in the act of any worship was forbidden. They were to be covered not only with undergarments, but outer garments. And the linen garments on his body signify his special role to deal with the leftovers. So if it's been burning all night, well, that altar is not going to look very clean. It's going to be very messy. There's going to be ash. And this priest is going to remove the ashes that the fire has reduced the burnt offering to. And he's going to put them beside the altar. He's the only one qualified to do this. He couldn't say, you know what, I'm supposed to be there at this particular morning to remove those ashes, but I'm going to let so-and-so, who's not of the Levites, go and do that. You can't have someone take your place. You're the priest, and you got to go in that morning, and you've got to clear the ashes and put them beside the altar. And now you have to dispose of those ashes. They've got to leave the courtyard. But because your clothing could be contaminated by the dumping of those ashes outside, you've actually got to change clothes now in verse 11. He shall take off his garments, put on other garments. I don't know, did he have a backpack with him with like his second change of clothes? Who knows how this worked? But then you're going to carry ashes outside the camp to a clean place. So you're going to have your priestly garments on to deal with the altar. But now that you're no longer on the altar, you can change. This is incredibly important because it symbolizes the holiness of that spot. You couldn't even just wear anything you wanted to and mess with the altar. You had to have a certain garments that was God approved. And now that the ashes are off the altar, well, you can change clothes. And you can leave the tabernacle courtyard and you can go out and deposit them in a specific location. In verses 12 and 13, the fire on that altar shall be kept burning. It shall not go out. This would be considered a dereliction of duty if you were to allow the fire of God to leave. The priest shall burn wood on it every morning. He shall arrange the burnt offerings on it. It shall burn on it the fat of the peace offerings. Fire shall be kept burning on the altar continually. It shall not go out. I just want to note, that's not a small amount of pressure. That's like, okay, has anybody checked on the offering fire lately? I mean, we've got to be making sure that if God has said to Moses that fire's not going to go out, that the guy who was responsible for it said, oh, wait, he shows up and it's... So at the end of Leviticus 9, one thing that we notice is that God himself brings a divine fire to the offering. And that could also signify its importance here. What's going on is just not of man. This is something of God, and it symbolizes the value and significance of the offerer being received through the death of that animal. Let's revisit the grain offering. In verses 14 to 23 of chapter 6, it says, "This is the law of the grain offering. The sons of Aaron shall offer it before the Lord in front of the altar." We've seen this back in Leviticus 2. And we know that you could have cooked or uncooked flour, and that's what's being referred to here in verse 15. "One shall take from it a handful of fine flour of the grain offering and its oil and frankincense that's on the grain offering and burn this as its memorial portion on the altar, a pleasing aroma." So you would prepare in some way, cooked or uncooked, this flour, and the priest would take a portion of it and burn that on the altar. So you've got multiple things burning on here at the same time. You've got a burnt offering and a grain offering often seen together. So it's not like, okay, is the burnt offering done? Let's go ahead and put the next offering on. It was totally acceptable and advisable for multiple things being offered at the same time. The procedure just had to be carefully followed. Then in verse 16 and 17, what we notice is that the rest of it, Aaron and his sons shall eat. This is the way God provides for the priesthood. The priests had such diligent work at the tabernacle, it's not like they could be out in the fields keeping sheep or at houses with flocks and herds of this or that. So how are they going to eat? There will be portions of the offerings God specifies to go to them. Here's an example of this. In verse 16, "The rest of it Aaron and his sons shall eat. It shall be eaten unleavened in a holy place. In the court of the tent of meeting they shall eat it. It shall not be baked with leaven. I have given it as their portion of my food offerings. It is a thing most holy, like the sin and the guilt offering." In verse 18, "Every male among the children of Aaron may eat of it, as decreed forever throughout your generations." By saying every male among the children of Aaron, that's another way of putting it. It's a priestly offering. Aaron was the priest, and so would his children be of the priestly line. "Whatever touches them shall become holy." Now, the end of verse 18 depends on your translation. In the ESV, it says, "whatever touches them shall become holy." Probably, though, it should say, "whatever touches them must be holy." It could be translated either way, and I think at the end of verse 18, what's being argued is, not just anyone can partake of this special leftover portion. It's for the priests, and they are a holy priesthood set apart by God. Whatever touches these offerings must be or shall be holy. It's not a promise of like transferring holiness, like you touch an electric outlet and electricity gets transferred from that thing into you. I don't think this is a transfer of holiness. Instead, this is a way of saying you shall be holy in order to touch it. And then in verses 19 and 20, the Lord speaks to Moses, "This is the offering that Aaron and his sons shall offer to the Lord on the day when he is anointed, a tenth of an ephah of fine flour as a regular grain offering, half in the morning and half in the evening." So here is a little subcategory. For this grain offering, the high priest, on the day he becomes high priest, is going to offer something to the Lord of a grain. He's going to offer it entirely to the Lord, half in the morning and half in the evening. In verse 21, "It shall be made with oil on a griddle. You shall bring it well mixed in baked pieces like a grain offering and offer it for a pleasing aroma to the Lord." In verse 22 and 23, the priest from among Aaron's sons, who's anointed to succeed him, shall offer it to Yahweh as decreed forever. The whole of it shall be burned. Every grain offering of a priest shall be wholly burned. It shall not be eaten. One of the ways the priest would eat then is that people would bring a grain offering and they would have a sample of it. Here's the exception. If you were becoming the high priest and you had a special offering you were giving of grain, all of it would be burned. All of it. Because it was symbolizing you being set apart in tribute and devotion to God. And that's what that seems to signify. In the book of Hebrews, there may be an allusion to this. I'll give you a possible text here. In Hebrews chapter 7, we're told in verse 27 that Jesus has no need, like the high priest, to offer sacrifices daily for his own sins and then for the people. He did this once for all when he offered up himself. So there were frequent sacrifices the high priest would offer. This would be contrasted with Jesus, who only offers himself once. It's not like he had something in the morning and something in the evening. It's not like he offered something weekly or something monthly. He came once to lay down his life. Let's revisit the sin offering. In verses 24 through 30, you see the sin offering, also known as the purification offering. We're told in verse 24 and 25, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the law of the sin offering. In the place where the burnt offering is killed, shall the sin offering be killed before the Lord, its most holy. That place is the altar. At that location is the altar in the courtyard, that bronze altar of sacrifice. In verse 26, the priest who offers it for sin shall eat it. In a holy place it shall be eaten in the court of the tent of meeting. So here's what we know from the previous instructions from Leviticus 4. The sin offering was to be given, but we weren't told what happens with the other meat of the sacrifice. We know that kidneys were offered, a lobe of liver was offered, the fat of the animal was offered. Those are the common elements. But what about the rest of it? Well, we get some expansion here, and we're told, well, it's for the priest. In other words, if you were a priest, you did not have to live on bread alone. You could also enjoy meat. And so the bread and the meat from the offerings would be yours, whether from the grain offering or here from the sin offering. We're told in verse 27, whoever touches its flesh must be holy, which means this is food for the priest, and the priest is the one who can touch it. And when any of its blood is splashed on a garment, you shall wash that on which it was splashed in a holy place. All right, well, let's say you're the priest. Obviously, this is a messy job. You're going to have blood involved in everything you're doing during the day, nearly. Your clothing will probably get something on it. And if clothing gets on it, you are not allowed to leave the tabernacle with sacrificial blood upon you. It has to be clean. Nor are you to allow some kind of vessel or pottery that might get blood splashed on it to remain. Look in verse 28. An earthenware vessel in which it is boiled shall be broken. If it's boiled in a bronze vessel, that shall be scoured and rinsed in water. So if you have a bronze vessel that could be cleaned if blood was on it, that's fine. But there are kinds of vessels that might be what you call porous in their surface. That if you get something in it, it's not so easily clean. Well, you just got to break that. Didn't matter if your great-great-great-grandpa sent it down through the line, right? If it's something on which blood spatters and you were just bringing something in your offer in it to offer that day into the tabernacle, it's not allowed to leave. That's because the blood applied is symbolizing what goes to the Lord. And you're not setting apart pottery or vessels or garments and letting them leave the tabernacle. This is some additional information we did not get in earlier chapters. And that might seem strange to us at first. Like, my goodness, just a little blood on the garment, just a little blood on the pottery. Why such a drastic reaction? We must not downplay the symbolism of the sprinkling or spreading of blood. And that's what is to be guarded and not just flippantly thought of. In verse 29, he says, every male among the priests may eat of this offering. It's most holy. But no sin offering shall be eaten from which any blood is brought into the tent of meeting to make atonement in the holy place. It shall be burned with fire. So here's the exception here. Back in the sin offering chapter of Leviticus 4, I said to you from Leviticus 4 that if you were a priest and you had sinned against the Lord unintentionally, then you had to bring blood into the the actual tent of meeting, and you were denied any part of that offering because it was actually for your sins. And so none of that then was something you were to benefit from because it was connected to your sin. And so if your sin offering was for your unintentional transgression, and that was proven by you had to take blood into the holy place, well, then all of that offering was consumed and none of it was eaten. Let's revisit the guilt offering. Here's the fourth of the five, revisiting the guilt offering in chapter 7. In chapter 7, this is the law of the guilt offering. It is most holy. In the place where they kill the burnt offering, they shall kill the guilt offering, and its blood shall be thrown against the sides of the altar. That's again this bronze altar in the courtyard. In verse 3, all its fat shall be offered, the fat tail, the fat that covers the entrails, two kidneys with the fat that's on them at the loins, the long lobe of liver that he shall remove with the kidneys. The priest shall burn them on the altar as a food offering to the Lord. It's a guilt offering. This is from Leviticus 5, and what I wanted us to think through last time we looked at this is the reasoning for the fat and the kidneys and the liver lobe. This seems odd, okay? Initially, when we look at this as readers, you might prefer a different part of the animal. You might say, well, the fat, you know, you might just cut that off, like I and some others recently have talked about, it, as is our practice. Others of you have told me that you really enjoy that part of the animal. Meat was not necessarily a frequent part of the Israelite diet. So to have meat was very special, and to have the fat of the animal was considered the best portion of the animal. If we know that, then they're saying the best belongs to God. By presenting the fat on the altar and burning the fat, they are saying through that symbolism, God is worthy. That is what they are saying. It is a way of exalting God's worth and his due. By actually detailing the fat tail and the fat that covers the entrails, that's the same principle. What about the kidneys and the liver? These are crucial to the inner life of the animal. It gets into the guts and the organs of the animal. And we are to love the Lord from our heart, from our inward being. Our heart and inner life is to animate toward God and to be aimed at honoring and glorifying God. That's now symbolized in devoting the inner life of that animal to God. So that's why the kidneys and the lobe of liver are specified here. They're to symbolize the life of the animal being laid down. In verse 6, we're told that every male among the priests may eat of it. It shall be eaten in a holy place. It is most holy. So here's what you get to do if you're among the priests. You get to partake in that meat that's left over, just not the fat, the kidneys, or the liver. Now in verse 7, the guilt offering is just like the sin offering. There's one law for them. The priest who makes atonement with it shall have it. This might actually mean if you were the priest officiating, that meat would be yours not only to eat, but yours to distribute should you not be able to eat the whole animal. It wouldn't just be given to everyone necessarily. In verse 8, the priest who offers any man's burnt offering shall have for himself the skin of the burnt offering. So if you've wondered, well, what happens to that hide, that skin? Well, of the burnt offering, the priest who offers it gets to take it. That could be very useful. It could be useful because of the hide. It could be useful for how it could provide shelter or clothing. The reason the priest receiving the hide of an animal could be helpful is, remember, you don't have special allotments where you're given pastures and herds. Your focus, your livelihood, is at that tabernacle. That's the focus inside the Israelite camp. This means you don't have just easy access to animal skins and hides. This, then, is a blessing for you as a priest. In verses 9 and 10, we're told that every grain offering baked in the oven and all that's prepared on a pan or griddle shall belong to the priest who offers it. Every grain offering mixed with oil or dry shall be shared equally among all the sons of Aaron. He's again helping us see here in chapter 7, God's providing for his Israelite leaders and priests through the provisions of the people. I think you could recognize how this principle actually works in the new covenant community, because you have the churches of the Lord Jesus Christ who help to sustain not only the ministries of the church, but ministers of the church. And you see the Old Testament precedent for this kind of thing that's kept in pattern with the New Testament as well. Even though I'm not a Levitical priest, there are obviously differences between the Old Covenant and the New. But there is this interesting principle that you see working in the New Testament that seems to rely on the spiritual leadership and teaching that the priests would provide in the Old Testament and how the Lord provides for them through the people of God. That seems to be carried on. Look in the last offering in chapter 7, starting in verse 11. We're going to revisit the last offering known here as the peace offering. This has been reserved for the last spot in the revisiting of the offerings, even though it wasn't in the last spot in the earlier order. If I were to number those earlier sacrifices 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, we have gone through them as 1, 2, 4, 5, and now 3. So the third one has been lifted out and now kept here, and it's given the lengthiest treatment, and that may be why. So in verse 11, this is the law of the sacrifice of peace offerings that one may offer to the Lord. We're told in verse 12, if he offers it, now here are some possible ways or reasons you would offer a peace offering. Because you were thankful to the Lord for the fellowship that you have enjoyed. He has delivered you in some way. He says here, if he offers it for thanksgiving. So here's a possible subcategory of the peace offering, a thanksgiving offering. Now, there are psalms and prophets that actually highlight the thanksgiving offering. So here's what I want you to know. Let's listen to Psalm 50, verse 14. Offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving. The way you would obey Psalm 50, 14 to offer a sacrifice of thanksgiving is you'd offer a peace offering. That's what that refers to. Or Psalm 56, 11, the psalmist says, I will render thank offerings to you. What did that involve? It's the peace offering. Or in Psalm 107, 22, let them offer sacrifices of thanksgiving and tell of his deeds in songs of joy. Thanksgiving offerings are very particular to the history of Israel's offerings. It's the peace offering, and this is a form of the peace offering. It tells us in verse 12, he shall offer with the thanksgiving sacrifice unleavened loaves. So not only the meat, but also bread. Loaves mixed with oil, unleavened wafers smeared with oil, loaves of fine flour well mixed with oil. In verse 13, with the sacrifice of his peace offerings for thanksgiving, he shall bring his offering with loaves of unleavened bread. So here you are as the priest, and up comes the Israelite, and you know what they have for their peace offering. They've got both bread and the offering. It's going to be a good day for you. You're going to get some of the bread, you're going to get some of the meat. And it says in verse 14, from it he shall offer a loaf, one from each offering. As a gift to the Lord, it shall belong to the priest who throws the blood of the peace offerings. It looks like then the priest who mediates that offering gets first dibs, if you could call it that way. In verse 15, the flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offerings for thanksgiving shall be eaten on the day of his offering. He shall not leave any of it until the morning. So you get to enjoy, along with the Israelite, the meat. But with a thanksgiving offering, it's got to be eaten the day of. In verse 16, if the sacrifice of his offering is a vow offering or a free will offering. So here's two other categories. Your peace offering could be for thanksgiving. Your peace offering could be for a vow that you were completing. Or your peace offering could be for a free will offering. What do those mean? I'm glad you asked. Let's think about a vow for a second. This might be something like the Nazirite vow, where we're told in Numbers chapter 6 that at the end of the Nazirite vow, he in verse 14 shall bring his gift to the Lord, and in verse 15, a basket of unleavened bread, loaves of fine flour, unleavened wafers, along with a grain offering. That's talking about the vow that's been completed that the Nazirite is going to give. Or think about the book of Jonah. Jonah was thrown into the sea. A great fish swallows him up. And here's what Jonah says in Jonah 2, verse 9. I, with the voice of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will pay. So when he promises, and having vowed to pay what he vows, that sacrifice will involve some kind of peace offering. And as a prophet, Jonah would be well-versed in the early books of the Pentateuch, the Torah, that includes Leviticus to give these offerings. A free will offering is a little bit different. You might not have been just rescued from the Lord. You might not be completing a vow. You might just be really thankful. And you could voluntarily, which is why it's called the free will offering, you could voluntarily of your own will come to the tabernacle and you'd want to offer something to the Lord, and you know it would benefit your family and the priest as well with the meat and bread. Has to be eaten by the second day. Look in verses 17 and 18. What remains of the flesh of the sacrifice, at the end of verse 16. It shall be eaten on the day that he offers his sacrifice, and on the next day, what remains of it shall be eaten. So you've got a couple days with the vow or free will offering. What if you wait till day 3? Oh no, that's a no-no. Look in verse 17. What remains of the flesh of the sacrifice on the third day shall be burned up with fire. If any of the flesh of the sacrifice of the peace offering is eaten on the third day, he who offers it shall not be accepted, neither shall it be credited to him. It is tainted, and he who eats of it shall bear his iniquity. And the idea may be that this meat or bread is in such a condition that it's no longer good or worthy to be eaten, and therefore you can't just say, I can shelve this and get to it eventually, and everything's fine. That would actually be dishonoring to the Lord. Let's put it this way. If the Lord has deemed that an unclean way to eat that bread or meat after several days, you would then be transgressing the holy things of the Lord. You would be breaking or committing, even unintentionally perhaps, a sin, and then you'd need to offer a sin offering because you wrongly ate the peace offering. You understand? Or guilt offering or trespass offering. And so you do well not complicating your life with these sacrifices. It's complex enough by doing it all right, much less starting to break and violate the standards. In verse 19, flesh that touches any unclean thing shall not be eaten. It shall be burned with fire. So what if your offering has been contaminated? It cannot be offered as a sacrifice or eaten. It's just going to be burned with fire. The person in verse 20 who eats of the flesh of the sacrifice of the Lord's peace offerings, while uncleanness is on him, that person shall be cut off from his people. So not only can you not eat an unclean offering, you can't be in a state of uncleanness while eating it either. The emphasis on a pure offering and a pure eater is clear. That last part of verse 20 seems strong. He shall be cut off from his people. What does that mean? At the very least, it may mean being sent and exiled for some time. It could mean being judged by the community unto death. It could mean being separated from God in the world to come, to being cut off from God's people. This is serious because if you flippantly related to God's law, you didn't care what your status was, you didn't care what the offerings were, then you weren't taking the Lord or his law seriously. In other words, you were revealing that your heart was not right before God. Those who cared about the Lord and took the Lord's glory seriously wanted to attend to the law of God. And they would not take their status flippantly, and they wouldn't just offer any offering no matter what happened. Cleanness and purity of offering and worshiper is important. So in verse 21, if anyone touches an unclean thing, whether human uncleanness, which probably means waste or defilement through skin disease, or unclean beast, or any unclean, detestable creature, and then eats some flesh from the sacrifice of the Lord's peace offerings, that person shall be cut off from his people. In verse 22, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel, saying, you shall eat no fat of ox or sheep or goat. Those are examples of herd and flock animals. He's saying the fat belongs to God, remember. The fat belongs to God. So you're not to eat the fat of those animals because you're wanting to live a life that symbolizes God's worth and knowing where you are in relation to God. I am God's worshiper, seeking to honor God with what is best. In verses 24 and 25, the fat of an animal that dies of itself and the fat of one that's torn by beasts may be put to any other use, but on no account shall you eat it. So let's say you come across, you know, let's just call it roadkill, okay? Something has been damaged by something else. You didn't cause the death of the animal. It's like, well, what about the fat at that point? No, you don't get to eat the fat of an animal you didn't kill either. Because earlier, it's clear that if you slice the throat of the animal, its fat is off limits. So it's off limits as well if it dies of itself or is torn by beasts. That fat might be used for something else. It's just not for food. In verse 26, moreover, you shall eat no blood whatever, whether of fowl or of animal, in any of your dwelling places. This is because blood represents the life of the animal. The pouring out of the blood is the emptying out of life. And the Lord is the author of life. And the Lord is the giver and taker of life. And so by eating the blood of the animals, the Israelites would be saying something untrue about God and themselves. They would be confusing who's God and the author of life. And so not eating the blood communicated, this life belongs to God. Whoever in verse 27 eats any blood, that person shall be cut off from his people. Let's say somebody gets the laws of Moses then, these instructions revealed straight from a holy and righteous God, and the person says, I think that's a gross overreaction. What's the big deal about blood? I'm just going to go ahead and eat it. That person thinks lightly of the law of God. That person is not considering that the God of heaven and earth, who's come to dwell among sinners, has made known how people may approach him. This person has received those words, and they do not care. In verses 28 and 29, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the people of Israel, saying, whoever offers the sacrifice of his peace offerings to the Lord shall bring his offering to the Lord from the sacrifice of his peace offerings. His own hand shall bring the Lord's food offerings. He shall bring the fat with the breast, that the breast shall be waved as a wave offering before the Lord. So let's specify what's being spoken about here. The breast meat of the animal is going to be followed in a moment by the right thigh of the beast. So if you are the priest, you don't just get any kind of meat of the animal. It's actually specified for you. So the person is going to bring with their peace offering for the Lord, they're going to make sure that the breast meat is waved before the Lord. Now, we don't know what this looks like. If they have cut the breast meat and they're like literally waving it, like you're trying to get somebody's attention, is it some sort of just elevated motion? It's not clear because the motion is not described. But it seems that that motion dedicates whatever this meat is to the priest. And then we're told in verse 31, the priest shall burn the fat on the altar, but the breast meat shall be for Aaron and his sons. And then not only the breast meat, but in verse 32, the right thigh of the beast, you shall give to the priest as a contribution from the sacrifice of your peace offerings. In verse 33, whoever among the sons of Aaron offers the blood of the peace offerings and the fat shall have the right thigh for a portion. In verse 34, for the breast that is waved and the thigh that's contributed, I have taken from the people of Israel out of the sacrifices of their peace offerings and have given them to Aaron the priest and to his sons as a perpetual due from the people of Israel. This is the portion of Aaron and of his sons from the Lord's food offerings. From the day they were presented to serve as priests of the Lord, the Lord commanded this to be given them by the people of Israel from the day that he anointed them. It is a perpetual due throughout their generations. Now that takes us nearly to the end of the chapter. And what we're noting here is, here near the end of chapter 7, God is reiterating his care for the people of God's leaders. He's providing for the priests and the priests' families. We have revisited the five offerings. How does chapter 7 end, which closes this important section of Leviticus? It summarizes, just a few statements, what will transition to the next part of Leviticus. In verse 37, this is the law of the burnt offering, the grain offering, the sin offering, the guilt offering. Now, there's a word now here, the ordination offering, more on that in just a second, the peace offering, which the Lord commanded Moses on Mount Sinai, on the day he commanded the people of Israel to bring offerings to Yahweh in the wilderness of Sinai. The ordination offering will be explained as the priests are set apart for their actual service. This is not a new regular offering. So it's tucked in there, but it's about to be narrated. We have seen these five offerings given in chapters 1 through 6, and then in the latter part of chapter 6 into 7, we've seen each of these offerings revisited. I was watching a video that Catherine Miller had recommended to me several weeks ago when we were starting our series in Leviticus. And it was a group called the Bible Project that puts together these narrations of overviews of Bible books. And she said, there's this great part as they're talking about the outline of Leviticus where they say all of the offerings, all five of these offerings can basically be divided into two categories. I'm sorry and thank you. And I think that's the right way to look at it. If you think of these five offerings, the I'm sorry offerings are the burnt offering, the sin offering, the guilt offering. But the thank you offerings, that's the peace offering and the grain offering. It's coming to Lord with thanksgiving is coming to the Lord with praise. It's not because you had sin. It's because those other I'm sorry offerings have been given. The Lord invites Israel to live in a camp around him so that their existence can be characterized by contrition and brokenness over sin and thanksgiving for God bringing them through these sacrifices, if you will, into communion. That's a good way to think about it, friends. With these five offerings, they mean I'm sorry and they mean thank you. And that's a clever way to capture what we've just revisited as well with the revisiting of these offerings. Here's what the altar pictures. This bronze altar with the fire coming out. This is like the mouth of God. They're called food offerings. So when you read in Hebrews 12:29 that our God is a consuming fire, think this. Think the fact that something being consumed and brought to nothing by God's holy and righteous mouth, that's what's being pictured here. And that in Hebrews 12 is a warning. It is a warning. Because we will either stand before a holy God with no refuge or covering, or our hope will be the substitute God has provided. And that's what takes us to Christ, isn't it? When you think of the I'm sorry offerings, Jesus is the burnt offering. Jesus is the one whose entire life is laid down for us to satisfy the justice of God. Jesus is that purification or sin offering because defilement has reached us inside and out. And Jesus' blood brings cleansing to our lives. Jesus' death is the guilt offering. There's no greater guilt offering or reparation or trespass offering, the other names it goes by, than Jesus. Because we have all trespassed God's holy things. We have transgressed the boundaries of his holiness. And we have accrued a debt we cannot pay. But Jesus is the guilt offering. Jesus' life is given in its entirety, only to be taken up again in order to be pleasing to his Father. Jesus' crosswork is the pleasing aroma to God, greater than anything that ever happened on a bronze altar in a courtyard. Because Jesus was able to say what no high priest had ever said, it is finished. They could never let the fire go out. Because in the morning and in the evening and in the morning and in the evening, there were daily offerings to be given. But one day, the fire of the burnt offering altar need not burn anymore. There would not need to be continual offerings given, for Christ ascends to the Father with a finished sacrifice, a new covenant established, and Christ's blood work on the cross is received by God as the sufficient atoning work for sinners. Friends, this is what makes Leviticus 1 through 7 point to the gospel. Because just as the seeds in Genesis 3 with Adam and Eve's covering were then taken up in a more corporate, systematic way with the different offerings, it was all heading toward the cross and God's grand plan. So it's surprising when Jesus says in John 6, "Eat my flesh, drink my blood." Wait a second. In what sacrifices ever offered, were you taking the blood? And even with the flesh being offered, you were sharing it with priests and everything else. For Jesus to offer himself entirely to us, eat my flesh, drink my blood, he is speaking of himself as a sacrificial offering to be received by faith. In a way, the fire of God has not gone out. It's just not on the bronze altar anymore. You know, this was the dwelling place of God. But if you read in the book of Acts, here they were in Acts 1 in the upper room. And they were waiting for the pouring out of the Spirit of God. And in Acts chapter 2, it comes. And the gospel proclamation would begin in Jerusalem and beyond to where we have heard the gospel throughout our days and years as well. And upon the heads of the people would be tongues of fire. And it's not because these people were going to be consumed as an offering or because they were a bronze altar like what was beforehand. But they, the church of Jesus Christ, have been marked out and set apart by the fire of God, if you will, by the Holy Spirit himself, where we are God's dwelling place. And so when God says, be holy because I am holy, and when we're called to follow the Spirit and bear the fruit of the Spirit and not give way to the desires of the flesh, it's because we are a sanctuary. And we don't have parts like the tent and the tabernacle and the basin and the lampstand. But God Most High in Christ is united to us through faith. And we have become the body of Christ, of which he is the head. And in doing so, God has made us to be a holy people. He dwells in us by his Holy Spirit. And therefore, when we think about living a life that seeks purity, the pure in heart seeing God, when we think of cleansing our lives from sin and turning from what is wicked, friends, that is because we have all become a holy priesthood. That is because we are the sanctuary of the Spirit himself, with the very tongue of fire of God upon us, set apart for his glory and honor. All of these Levitical sacrifices are pointing to the glorious work of Christ on the cross and his beloved church, the people of God. Let's pray.